This is Walker's Point, Kennebunkport, Maine. The place that the President and Mrs. Bush call home. We talked to them here 2 years ago, and we met here again last week for their first television conversation since the inauguration.
The President and Mrs. Bush, talking with David Frost.
We talked first with the President.
Mr. President, or should I also use your other new title, Mr. Smooth, as well?
You can use it. In fact, if you looked over your right shoulder, I can show you where I earned that title. That's the horseshoe pit over there.
Right. And that's the way you earned it.
Showing a smooth horseshoe. Yeah, it's a phenomenal shoe, actually. I'm not very good in horseshoes, but we've had more fun with that game for the last 4 or 5 years. All the kids can play. They all have the same arrogance factor as their grandfather or their dad, and it's a great family sport.
And so, was it one of them who coined the name, or did you coin the name?
I felt they were getting around to it, but I actually came up with it first.
What's been the hardest decision for you so far in the first 7 months?
Well, I guess sometimes the hardest decision is not going with impulse, with instinct. When I saw Colonel Higgins' body displayed in that brutal, cruel fashion, I had this visceral reaction of wanting to do something. I still want to do something. I want to punish those who victimized this outstanding Marine who was wearing the uniform of the United Nations. But you want to be realistic. I don't want to put innocent lives at risk to avenge one. I don't want to see mothers and children weeping anymore because of some action I might take. On the other hand, if I could vindicate the death of this outstanding soldier and punish in a way so as to inhibit future such brutal terrorism, I'd do it in an instant. But I guess what I'm saying is when you get into the realities of the situation, it's a little different than when you're given the campaign speech for running for Congress, in my case, or primary running for president, or in a campaign for president.
So that you have the emotion and you feel it very deeply, but then you have to somehow put that on one side.
I've got to think of other American lives and the lives of others. I mean, so I don't cite this as a great burden of the presidency, but it's a reality versus, gut instinct in the beginning.
At the beginning of this year, when I was talking to Margaret Thatcher after Lockerbie, and she said to me that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is always wrong because revenge can hurt innocent people. But in a sense, you're disagreeing with that to a certain extent. There is a case for retribution.
Yes, there is. Clearly. If I could find a way to surgically go in and free those American hostages, I would do it. And but regrettably, the situation isn't that clear. And so, in terms of our hostages, we are exhausting every diplomatic avenue I can think of and that our able professionals can think of. But yes, there's a time when you must do that.
I sort of sense between the lines that as you think through that situation, that if in fact people hadn't responded to your plea for the life of Mr. Sosipio, that might have been an occasion where you would have felt that about retribution.
Well, I haven't outlined what I might do, but clearly that would have upped the stakes and upped the ante. But as I said, it's not... I mean, when I saw the picture of Higgins, I felt what every American felt, this determination to go do something about it. We were just so deeply offended by the brutality and the unconscionable display of this man's body. I still want to say alleged. because we haven't even had the decency, these terrorists, of returning the body to the family, which just kills me. But, you know, you have this feeling of wanting to do something, and but if there's a further escalation or further evidence of a state sponsoring this kind of terrorism, the United States will not and must not be impotent.
And both Iran and Syria have considerable sway over these terrorists, don't they?
Well, we're, I think, in varying degrees, they do. But whether they can snap their fingers with finality and have a hostage release or a pack of hostages released, we're not positive about that. But we feel that they, particularly in this, in the instance of the American hostages, Iran has a bears a disproportionate responsibility for not having those hostages freed.
Would you expect in the course of your administration or two administrations, would you expect us to have diplomatic relations with Iran?
I'd like to think we could see that day, and I'd welcome it. But there has to be a certain modicum of international decency in order to achieve that end. But we have no historical feud with Iran, and I have no desire to intervene in their internal affairs. But I do think that as long as Americans are held hostage and from time to time their officials make statements indicating they have some control over that situation, that that's got to change dramatically before there can be the kind of relations that I personally would like to see with Iran.
When you look at a problem, though, like some of the big problems you've mentioned, I mean, do you automatically look at them in terms of what you can do over an eight-year span rather than a four-year span?
No, I'm focusing on a four-year span. And, I mean, what can we accomplish within the next budget cycle or the next 2 years? Or, now, in some legal ways, you've got to project 5 years into some of your budget forecasting and things of this nature. But I'm not looking at it like an eight-year presidency. I'm approaching it, certainly, I guess you have to say, within the parameters of a four-year presidency.
So you're looking at the problems over 4 years. Although, you, I mean, you do plan to be a two-term president.
Well, if I didn't, I wouldn't tell you, because then I would be what you call the earliest lame duck in history. You know how that works.
Yeah. They always say that it's the loneliest job in the world, the presidency, but I get the impression you disagree with that.
I do disagree with it. It's not lonely, there are people around all the time. That's not exactly what she meant. But no, seriously, it's, I think it would be presumptuous to suggest that we have faced the ultimate crisis of something of that nature. I haven't been through, tested by real fire, been through hell in this job, but I do see as it goes along the complexities of it and the importance in the sense of what you say and influencing others or what you do having effect on the lives of other people. I'm a little more cautious than I was in the very, very beginning of how I say things, but I hope when I finish my term as president that I haven't had to, you know, reach out for understanding about the loneliest job in the world, because it is too fulfilling, and it is too, you got too many good people helping and sharing the problems and trying to take the problems off your shoulders to feel that you need what I would say is self-pity.
You've had, as you say, you haven't had that, praise God, that terrible crisis or whatever yet. The saddest moments, of course, were you were talking about Colonel Higgins, Lieutenant Colonel Higgins, and the USS Iowa, too.
Kids, oh, yeah.
That really got to you, didn't it?
Yes, it does. We Bushes cry easily. And it's not just emotion. I mean, it's not just visible manifestations of emotion, but it's what you feel in your heart. And those get me. I'm not good at expressing the concerns of a nation and matters of national concern like that. I'm just not very good at it. And so you try not to choke up. You try to say what you really think. But I feel very moved when I see those kinds of tragedies. I mean, you feel a certain responsibility, and you feel a certain frustration, particularly in terms of these hostages.
Do you feel in that sense, as the head of state particularly, rather than the political leader, is it almost as though in moments like that they all become, the nation becomes, in a way, members of an extended family?
Yes, I think you look at it when there's some tragedy of that nature. The country feels, we're feeling people. And we come together when the kids in the Isle are killed in a terrible accident, or a plane goes down, a tragedy of an airliner sabotaged by terrorists, or the death of a Marine colonel. We feel these things in our heart. And we come together, we cross over our political lines, and we start blaming, oh, you should have done this. But as a country, we're emotional when it comes to those kinds of things. One sparrow falling from the sky.
This is a more emotional country than some. You're quite right, isn't it?
I think it is. I think it is. We wear our emotions on our sleeves sometimes.
And in fact, you turned down one draft of a speech about the Iowa, didn't you, because you thought you couldn't get through it?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe more than one.
Really?
Maybe more than one. You know, because it's too... I feel it. And if you really feel sad, then you, I guess you act sad. If you feel a certain loss, why, it shows up more.
Absolutely.
Maybe people understand.
I think they do. Now that we have a non-communist government in Poland, would you call Poland now an ally of the United States?
I think we're waiting to see how Poland evolves. What I want to do is see that the West, certainly in my country, our country, fulfills our, to the best of our ability, helps them fulfill their promise. And certainly when it comes to something like food aid, we should, all of us, be as responsive as possible. But an airlift of money is not the answer. And the Polish authorities know this. Lech Wałęsa knows it. Jaruzelski knows it. I expect their new prime minister knows it. And what is needed is to encourage and do what we can to help them implement the reforms that are needed so that the money does not just evaporate into a great swamp.
But would we be prepared to give them more aid as well, financial aid?
I'd love to be able to give them more aid. We've proposed a major package. As a matter of fact, just a couple of days ago, a minority leader and our Secretary of Labor were here, the Doles, and just we discussed what more we can do. But they made clear to the Polish officials, just as I did, that we do not have a bottomless pit. We are fighting a very large deficit that ties our hands in terms of American largesse.
How many of the words can we put aside now? Cold War, as that is a phrase, has that gone?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't use that phrase because we have been impressed with the moves towards perestroika. You mind an imposter coming in the middle of this weighty question here?
No. Is this Millie?
That's Millie. Millie, did your mother send you in here? Now, go on. I'm talking some serious stuff, Ed. Where were we?
We were talking about the word Cold War.
Yeah, Cold War. Cold War is, I hope we never return to Cold War days. The American position, position of this president, and I believe of the vast majority in Congress is, we want perestroika to succeed. We want glasnost to continue. And I have sent that signal to Mr. Gorbachev over and over again. I'm sure he understands that.
You're a great believer in person-to-person diplomacy,
yes,
and so on. Do you trust Mr. Gorbachev?
I I would... My problems are not with Mr. Gorbachev, but they're with a system that systematically has denied a lot of the values that we hold dear. And when I hear him taking some very forthright positions for reform and for openness, I salute that. I'll try to answer your question, but that isn't the question. You do not build a foreign policy based on one man. Gorbachev would no more develop the foreign policy of the United States based on his perception of its president than he would jump in a rocket and fly out there to Neptune.
Right.
Nor would I make judgments, fundamental strategic judgments, about the Soviet Union, because whether I like Mr. Gorbachev or not, or because whether I think he's open and reform-minded. And I do think he is open. And I do think he is reform-minded. And I do think he is trying very, very hard. And the rhetoric that sometimes can separate you is way toned down. We've had some, reason to make that statement with confidence.
So that you can't build a foreign policy on one man who might not be there. But, I mean, when he says something to you or makes an undertaking to you, you trust him in that situation. Do you trust his
word? I would say so far in our relations with Mr. Gorbachev, previous administration in this, he has tried very hard to fulfill any undertakings that he has made. And that's right. That's how you make a judgment. So I think that he's working to keep his word. I've no reason to fault him on his word.
When you say that you can't build it on one man, if you look ahead, there's been a debate within the administration on this. I mean, in 5 or 6 years' time, I mean, are you confident that he will prevail in Russia?
I think it's too early to predict with any accuracy what the internal situation in the Soviet Union is going to look like 4 or 5 years from now. I'm hopeful, and I want to see progress continue, but they are facing enormous economic problems, David. Enormous economic problems. And sometimes I think we've got the biggest ones, but not when you look at the Soviet Union, or indeed Eastern Europe, and the two, interact to some degree. So I don't think we can accurately predict that, or say with certainty, this is the way that Politburo is going to look, or this is the way the philosophical underpinnings of the Politburo Central Committee are going to be.
So you think your position is a bit safer than his?
Being president? Yeah, I have utter confidence that they won't throw me out.
Yeah.
And but I would expect if you put the question to him, he'd say the same thing. And I have no reason to believe that Mr. Gorbachev will be put out of office. I have seen no evidence, no estimates, no, you see, articles from time to time, but I see no evidence of that.
How do you keep in touch when you haven't had a summit? I mean, have you spoken to Mr. Gorbachev on the phone or on the hotline since you became president?
The hotline is a teletype.
Right.
You have to use your credit card to call him on a regular line.
Right.
And we've been in touch, and some of the things are very good. I'm trying to think. There were several things, and maybe one of them was the Iowa when those kids lost their lives. Maybe. I think it was. If it wasn't, it was something else dealing with the lives of young Americans. And a very sensitive and thoughtful letter. And I got word from him at the time our son and grandson went in private capacities to Yerevan at the time of the earthquake. Very warm and sentimental and convincingly real response of gratitude just for that little show of interest, you see.
So
these things are good. These tones are right.
Do you think that in your time the Berlin Wall will be dismantled?
Yep.
You've asked for it and you think...
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. When I was in Hungary and Chairman Nemeth actually handed me a piece of the barbed wire between Hungary and Austria and presented it in front of the news media, and with a Hungarian flag on this plaque and some words about all these walls must come down, some barriers must come down. I confessed earlier in this talk about sometimes getting emotional, and that was very emotional, very.
Yeah.
I mean, to just to feel what he was saying. This has come down now. And I was thinking back to the tanks, 1956 or something. And it was so moving. And yes, that Berlin Wall will come down.
In one poll, a majority of Americans said that they feared the Japanese economic threat more than the Russian military threat. What would you say about that?
I don't like that. I don't like it because I don't want to see us pull back into some kind of a protectionism, some kind of an isolation from a very important ally, Japan. And I think there's some misunderstanding about this. I think the Japanese should redouble their efforts to permit us access to their markets, because when I say free and fair trade, that's exactly what I mean. Fair equals access to markets. Let us compete, and if we can't compete, too bad. You buy somebody else's goods. But if we can compete, we should have access. And they have almost unlimited access to our markets. So I think the American people sense an inequity. And they also see that the Japanese have come in with a good deal of ownership of some of our ability to produce goods and services in this country. And I think those two things together make that, produce the kind of results you're talking about. But Japan is a friend. We have common interests in the Pacific in terms of our national security and Japanese national security. I do not want to see Japan almost pushed into a reinvigorated militance. I don't want that. So how do you avoid that? You keep them in the family of free and open and fair, free enterprise nations, and they're awful good at it. We simply cannot have any discriminatory impulses against our friends from Japan or Asia or anybody else. Can't do that in our country. We're too big for that. Too big-hearted. Never have been that kind of people.
Talking about a near neighbor of Japan's, on the subject of China, how soon would you hope that it would be business as usual again with China?
Well, how soon would I hope? The hope would be pretty soon. But how soon do I think? I don't know the answer to that one. Because right now, like as with other allies of ours, the relationships between the United States and China are somewhat strained for very understandable reasons.
What about those people who feel that in a way we're more generous towards China at the moment, that we didn't really come out strongly about the 7,000, up to 7,000 Tiananmen Square and so on, and that in a sense we're almost tougher with the Soviet Union on human rights than we are about what's happened in China? Do you think there's a bit of a different standard there?
I hope there's not a double standard in terms of our commitment. I don't recall any. The Soviet Union, as you know, has had grave problems with their own republics, and I don't recall our being hyper-interventionist into the internal affairs of the Soviet Union. We weren't at the time of the Chinese. We said what we thought. We always speak up for democracy and for freedom and for human rights, but I hope we don't have a double standard. I don't think that's a fair allegation.
Talking of a very different sort of person for a moment. You've met him a couple of times. Would you call General Noriega one of the few people you call an evil man?
I would now. I hadn't always had him characterized as this, but when he got immersed into the international drug business, I would have to say that, yeah.
We seem to have come to a full stop in terms of the OAS and everything else in doing anything about getting rid of him. What did you think of the President of Peru's plan, the Perez plan, that maybe if the United States said, we'll give the canal back in 5 years rather than 10, if there's democracy, that would blow away Noriega's support?
I don't think you need to change the terms of the Panama Canal Treaty. I don't think that is a factor in Noriega's behavior at all. I think he got caught up in the international drug trafficking. He has been indicted by the United States courts. He has violated treaty rights of ours, violated the treaty by refusing or kind of obstructing some of the free flow of our citizens that provided for in the treaties, or treaty rights. And so I don't think that suggestion is meritorious.
There's change also in South Africa. There's a new acting president in South Africa. Would you like one of his first actions to be to free Nelson Mandela?
Yes. And it would help things a great deal. And I'd like to think that he would do that. And he's made some statements, taken some steps, going to Zambia to see Kenneth Kaunda. Good. It's good to reach out to the frontline countries. And I've heard good things about Mr. de Klerk. And so, but you need something like the freeing of Mandela. The world needs it.
Before returning to the president, we talk next to Mrs. Bush.
What have been the most memorable moments or for you so far in the first 7 months, Barbara?
Gosh,
was it a trip or something that happened at home?
Well, certainly our trips have been extraordinary. I mean, the funeral in Japan, and I think I knew George was going to have a raging success in NATO, but I was glad for the rest of the world to see that. That had to, I think, have been the height.
That was such exhilarating. We happened to meet.
That's right, we
did. And it was exhilarating, wasn't
it? That's right. And then the next trip, the economic summit, was in Poland, was an extraordinary trip. I think we're living in a very exciting time. And so certainly those, I mean, when you think, David, what's happened in how many months? 9 months or less.
Yeah.
Besides having puppies and all the other things, we've had a very exciting time.
But the world is changing so much.
So quickly.
It's not. It's not just Gorbachev, but it's South Africa, too.
That's right. Well, South America.
Yeah.
I mean, not all good, not all bad, but an awful lot good is happening.
And what about the other side of the picture? You said somewhere, quote, that you worry sometimes about greed in America.
I do worry about that. I worry about greed around the world, but I really should put that the other way and say I'm extraordinarily impressed with all the CEOs that do so much. A lot of them are the same people, maybe, but I see a lot of people doing a lot of good, and that's exciting. But I do worry about greed.
What? Is it different from the way it was? I mean,
I don't know as it was. It's just that I'm more conscious of it, maybe, now. But I think we ought to get back to more thinking of others, less thinking of self. And maybe that's why I don't like to talk about myself so much.
Yeah. Yes, because, I mean, characteristics that are missing from our lives today that you remember from childhood, you mean?
Well, maybe, but no, I think that's right. I think there's a lot of greed out there, and we've got to be very careful. I'd like to see more love, more sharing. I get very upset about well, the thing that happened in New York this week, the racial, that just killed me. It was so unnecessary, so ugly, so hateful, so the bad side of the coin, when we have so much the good side of the coin.
Yes. And you're in so many battles, the literacy battle, and the photographs that stay with one are, I mean, the photograph of you with the AIDS baby. I mean,
and he died, you know.
Did
the
he?
Little baby.
Did he? What,
he
recently?
Died. Yes, he died about a month ago, the little baby. But that's life, I guess. But that
or
was
not,
sad.
As the case may be. The that's tragic
it.
Case may not
he
be.
He was born history, that baby. So sad.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll... I mean, I think we're getting good news on AIDS.
Yes, but yes, we are with the news mm-hmm. of the drug. But the fact that we remember the photo and there's that mm-hmm. tragic postscript, I mean, does... underline the way in which you have the power to dramatize issues.
Well, and that's
which
important.
Is quite a responsibility
that's right.
as well as an opportunity.
No, but it's an enormous opportunity because it does, I know from that particular home that it helped to have me go there and people gave more money and people were more understanding and they cared a little more.
As you look at those problems, are you a total optimist rather than a pessimist? Or
yes.
Where do you put yourself in this
No, spectrum? I'm a total optimist. But I know we have an awful lot more work to do. I really believe strongly that if each person just tackled one problem, the one next door to them, whether it's hate or greed or whatever, just giving a fellow a helping hand, I really believe we can make a difference. Mm. But it starts in your own neighborhood. Don't go out looking for great causes. Start where you are, because
yeah.
it's there.
Hey, as you talk, I remember a quote that, again, this may not
oh,
be
I hate
true.
My quotes.
No, but you did say in 1984 that if you were ever in the White House, you'd be like a caged animal.
I thought that, but it's not true. I just love it. I do a lot of things there that I mean, I feel very spoiled, but I swim a mile a day at the White House. I walk Millie every day. I had puppies, something I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
I don't feel caged at all.
I think one of the reasons that people respond to you is that it's clear that you are enjoying it so much.
I'm loving it. But so is he.
Yes, no.
Don't
and,
let him
and,
kid you about that.
No, he didn't. No, he
but
didn't.
You know, one thing I should say about George, he's got a lot of good qualities. But I think maybe the best quality was the people he surrounded himself with. Discounting me.
I was going to say Starling.
Discounting me. But I looked recently just at the people maybe on a trip or someplace and realize there are no jealousies, these are all people who are dedicated to helping the country. I think that's an enormous ability, David.
Mm. As someone once said to me, it's not just team spirit, it's the spirit of the team.
That's
as
right.
Well.
And this team is extraordinary. Mm. And I think that explains a lot of the sort of the reason we're having a good time.
Yes. Well, will you continue having a good time? Because then we can share it with you.
Oh, good. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Next, we turn to the subject of domestic issues with the President.
Mr. President, there's so much wondering always about this. When you said the magic words, no more taxes, was that intended to stand for 1 year as a firm commitment or for four? What was the small print?
There wasn't any small print. And what I'm trying to do is fulfill that pledge by going forward step by step on the budget without raising taxes. We're going to succeed this first year, I'm convinced, although we don't have that agreement yet, David. We're still, and then we got to see what happens. But it is my intention to fight every inch of the way for no more taxes. I have to do that.
But you wouldn't guarantee to us now that will obtain for the whole, you'll fight that hard,
I'd
but
like
you...
I guarantee it to you, but when I found something, I found a reality in life. And the reality is the United States Congress. And they act in strange and mysterious ways. And they have their constitutional responsibilities, and I have mine. But I'm going to take a giant step this year by accomplishing fulfilling the no more taxes pledge and then going right back into the battle to try to do it next year.
The phrase you must read all the time in connection with your plans and so on are the thing about how is he going to pay for all these things. He talks boldly about the space initiative that could cost $400 billion or $70 billion for the B-2 and going on through the list, more for education, more to fight drugs, all of that list. And then at the end of it they say, but where is he going to get the money from? He talks liberal, but he spends conservative, and all that sort of
thing. I like that.
Do you accept
I plead somewhat guilty of that, but not totally guilty of it. I don't talk liberal. I talk the interest of this country. We do have to do something in the fight in drugs and education. And I have put my dollar signs next to these various accounts that we send up to the Hill. It isn't all smoke and mirrors. There is money allocated in the way of doing it if they want to do it our way. Now, the problem you run into, Congress has their own priorities, and they set their own way of doing things. But I don't plead guilty to the charge that there's no dollar signs next to our proposals. Take the space proposal. I said, look, this should be a goal, a long-range goal, many, many years. And then somebody comes in, where are you going to get the $400 trillion or $1 billion to pay for it? Well, that's down the line. It's a goal for our nation. It isn't a short-run goal like our landing on the moon in 10 years. But I think you've got to keep. I think the country ought to have a vision. Remember, I'm the guy that they used this claim in the campaign had no vision. The vision thing that worried so many of my critics. Then you come up with a vision that the United States ought to keep its lead in space and ought to explore outside. And they start saying, same critics start coming back at you.
They say they want you to have a different vision there, though, that there's so much to do down here and such a shortage of money, so spend it here first.
Say that. That is an argument that is made by some, and I can give some credence to that. My point is that if you work it out properly, you can do both. We've got an active, well-funded space program right now. Some have argued all along we shouldn't have that because of some unfulfilled problems here on Earth. I don't agree with that.
But what about when you see some of the figures for defense and so on, and you care so passionately about being an education president and so on, when you see, don't you sometimes think, my goodness, if we had 133 stealth bombers, that's another $500 million for education or something like that?
I don't. You know why? You know why I don't think that? Because we spend more per capita on education than almost any country in the world, and other countries outdo us on accomplishment and scores. And a lot of it, in our system too, David, only 7% of the funding for education is federal, properly so. Because I don't want the federal government going into the public school system in Houston, Texas, telling what they can teach, saying what programs must be put into effect. I don't want the federal government to have a larger role. So the 7% figure is a lot of money, and we've come forward with a program that I think puts the emphasis where it belongs, on excellence and on rewarding good performers in the teaching profession and students and things of this nature. But quality education is not going to be solved solely by the federal government. And it isn't a function of more money for everything. I mean, if it were, why are other countries bettering us when we are spending more per capita? That I don't know, except that maybe their work habits are a little tougher. Maybe they've stayed with the fundamentals when we've been off exploring with some programs that weren't so fundamental.
Here at home, were you relieved when you didn't have the knotty problem of having to make a decision about a pardon for Oliver North?
Well, all along, I wasn't relieved because I didn't want to see Ollie North convicted. I was hoping he'd be found innocent.
This presidential pardon power, though, it's almost one of the few powers of a president you'd be better off without, really. It's always knotty, isn't it? I mean, would you have done if you'd been Gerald Ford? Would you have pardoned Richard Nixon when he did?
I think, it's easy for me to say yes, because Ford took a lot of heat on it, kept his chin up, and spared the nation a long, agonized period. And so I can empathize with that decision, but it's an easy one now to say sure, because the only people that'll be sore at you are a handful of people that still want Nixon nailed to the wall for some reason. I mean,
timing of when he did it ended his honeymoon in a way, though, didn't it?
It did. And that was one of the reasons. And he knew this. His advisors knew this. So I think the motivation of Gerald Ford was 100% correct. Sparing the nation the further agony of trying a president.
For people who are watching this conversation in the United States rather than around the world, following our conversation, there's going to be your first direct address, direct appeal to the nation. Was the fact that you chose the subject of drugs a deliberate signal that you regard this as the one
yes.
most important subject?
That it is. I can't say the most important when you're looking at jobs and you're looking at world peace and things that I feel strongly about in connection yep. with those two categories. But yes, the anti-narcotics fight must be won. I was impressed with President Barco had when he called on the consuming countries, particularly the United States, to stop consuming, to encourage through education the idea of reducing consumption. And it is a very important that we have a national strategy. And so I've got a good team working on it. And there is no coincidence. This is a determination that I try and my hardest, my best, to mobilize the nation. We've got to succeed in this.
And now that the Pentagon and others are talking about it so clearly as drugs being a threat to national security in Colombia, you've moved to help them very swiftly and so on. But I mean, given the vital nature of this fight, presumably you wouldn't rule out, if the president of Colombia asked, you wouldn't rule out American troops helping in the fight in Colombia?
No, but
you wouldn't rule that out.
I'm not ruling it in or out. I don't think the president of Colombia wants American troops. In fact, I know he doesn't. But if he changes his mind, fine.
But if he did change his mind and ask, you wouldn't rule it out.
I've learned, David, something since I last chatted with you, and that is not to answer a hypothetical question.
Yeah.
Because it gets you beyond where you want to be. But I've said, and I remind people back in the campaign, I talked of the possibility of the U.S. helping a country that didn't have the military means to go in there and wipe out some of these factories of death. I haven't changed my thinking, but I'm very sensitive to the sovereign rights, in this instance, of the state of Colombia.
When you were vice president, you're in the polls, you were 8 or 10% less approval rate than President Reagan. Vice President Quayle has been 20 to 25% behind you. Is that a reflection on how popular you are or on him?
It's a reflection, I guess, on the fact that they may not yet know the ability of Dan Quayle as I know it. And I couldn't care less what a poll says right now, unless it was a good one, and then I'll be talking about it. And if it's a bad one, I'll say, people don't yet understand what I understand, that he's a very able man and he's a team player and I made a good selection and I'm glad he's doing his job.
Right. Given that, then presumably, although you don't want to be specific about the second 4 years, but if you did run again, it would be a Bush-Quayle ticket.
I have learned never to go that far out in the future, because if I start commenting on that, then you're going to get me commenting on my own future beyond where I want to be.
So we want to leave them in a sort of educated limbo, both futures.
That was the two words I was groping for, yes. Educated limbo.
There's one subject. This is the, we know you want a kind of gentler America, but have you told Lee Atwater question?
Yeah, he's,
wherever you
he's
go
a kind and gentle kind of fella.
Yeah, well, that's
he's the kind of fella the Democrats love to go after. Do you know why? Because he's getting in their knickers. He's getting to them. And they're seeing Democrats leave the Democratic Party and join the Republican Party. So what do? They blame Atwater.
Yeah. They say you've got a double act, a good cop, bad cop act going on.
They say that about my able chief of staff and friend John Sununu in the White House. He's a good, bad cop because he can get tough at the Congress, and I'm the nice, good cop. So I've heard that about everybody, I guess. Anybody, time somebody has to make a tough decision. But I don't, on Atwater's behalf, plead guilty to his being a bad cop either.
Right.
they don't have the same ability in that Democratic National Committee anywhere.
You came in for some criticism and some praise when soon after a lunch with Mr. Atwater, you made your statement on a constitutional amendment on the flag and so on, and both sides have had their say on that. But one comment that interested me was somebody said, leaving aside the fact that both sides, whatever they want, are obviously in favor of the flag, but that to go for a constitutional amendment just for a few nuts who soil the flag seems like the nation is insecure.
No. Absolutely ridiculous. Totally wrong. If I could be satisfied by the lawyers, good lawyers, my attorney general, that this matter could be resolved by legislation that now many of the Democrats are embracing, and glad that they are, I'd be pleased to death about that. But look, David, the flag is something special. I am told, and I don't know if this is true or not, so I reserve the right to say that it may not be true, that Colonel Higgins was told that if he took the patch, the United States flag patch, the United States emblem, whatever it was, off of his uniform, that he would be in less danger of being kidnapped. And he refused to do it. I was told that it was a flag patch. And whether it's true or not, it would be true of hundreds of Marines and sailors and soldiers and guys like me and guys like the men and women all across this country. The flag is unique. I'm talking about laser-like specificity. And the American flag deserves the protection of the Constitution. And I don't care how many columnists assign political motives to me. They're wrong, and I am right, because I know how I feel about our flag, but I know how the rest of the country does.
Oh, absolutely. But it's because of the strength of that feeling in the flag that the suggestion is that it doesn't need this
protection. Liberal argument. I understand the argument against it, but I don't agree with it. And I'm the president, and I'm going to fight for what I believe in. And if this case does nothing but bring this to the attention of the American people, there's nothing wrong with that. Not going to violate. You don't have to go burn an American flag to have the right of free speech. There are plenty of inhibitions on free speech, properly found by the court. You don't, you know, the obvious one, you don't cry fire in a crowded theater kind of thing. And this one is laser-like protection for a unique symbol of the United States of America. And if I'm wrong, too darn bad, I feel really strongly about this.
And those who
I get accused all the time, politics, doing this for pandering to political interests. It's not right. That isn't why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I believe it is right. And I believe that I'll have strong support from the American people. And I don't believe it infringes in one single way on the legitimate right of free speech.
Because, in fact, on the subject of abortion, you are, in fact, taking a line which is overall unpopular in most polls.
I've spelled the position out clearly, and now people are saying, well, there's a mood change. Too bad. I'm elected. Here's my view. And I learned to win some, and I learned to lose some. But on these matters, I feel very strongly about it. People would like to have their president say this is what he feels, whether it's on the human life or whether it's on the American flag or whatever.
Is there any way, do you think, I mean, I know what you feel about the issue and it's going back to the States and so on, and Time magazine said this could be the most corrosive national debate since Vietnam. Is there any way to lower the temperature? Is there any way on abortion?
I don't think the temperature is any higher than it's been. I think the Supreme Court decision and then some statements by that national organization of women, the Molly Yard Group, where they were going to start a special party based on this issue and all. I mean, it got a great deal of real attention, and the issue is divisive. There are Americans that feel so strongly on one side and equal number that feel so strongly on the other. What I have to do is speak out against the excesses of demonstration, where you interfere with a person's constitutionally given rights of ingress or egress or whatever it might be. On whatever side of the issue, these the extreme demonstrations take place, Certainly try to have some respect for people that differ with me, but say what I think and fight for what I believe. I was elected president of the United States.
And you're going to run again.
And I'm going to, well, now, wait a minute.
I nearly got you there.
No, but it's you know, it's these issues, these two, and there's probably a handful of others like it, are very emotional with people. But I have great confidence that people down the road or my neighbors, wherever it is, would want to say, hey, at least the man's saying what he thinks, speaking from here, speaking from his heart about these things.
For the last part of our conversation, the president and I were joined by Mrs. Bush.
Does the presidency and the focus of put an added pressure on family life or not?
I think so. But we're very lucky. We have a very strong family. Our children love each other, which is important. I think they love us. We adore them. You know, George, who decided not to run for governor, is doing that thing in life which he wanted to do more than anything else in the world. He's the managing partner of the Texas Rangers.
Right.
And it's put a new dimension in our life. I can hardly wait to get to the sports page.
It's important they not get spoiled, or that they not think, because their dad is president, that they are entitled to something. But I am confident they'd never do that. They bend over backwards not to do that. And they don't send signals of self-importance to their business partners or their friends or their neighbors. I'm sure, I'm absolutely sure of that.
Did
I have total confidence that they go the other way. And it's important to our family and to them, their families, that that continue to be the case, and it will.
Did your father want you to go into politics very much?
Never discussed it with me, ever.
Contrary to what you read.
Yeah.
Well, that's really fascinating, because one gets the impression that it was almost a sort of thing written over the bed by him that you've got to live up to.
And the whole time he was in politics, I was living out in West Texas, except for the last 2 years. And the rumor is I watched him in his campaigns. I was never there when he was campaigning.
Nor did his father ever make a phone call for George, which I read fairly often.
Right.
Never.
Really?
Mm-mm.
But did you always know that this course would be the course your future husband was going to follow?
No. A lot of people say he told them, but he forgot to tell me.
But, I mean, do you think, Mr. President, you could have done all this, achieved all this, reached the pinnacle without the lady beside you?
No.
You know darn well you could have. He knows he could have.
No, I don't. And I think it's fair to say that the American people have a pretty good understanding of Barbara now.
Yeah. That's because I'm so deep.
they relate to you. The American people relate to you to a, not surprising to anyone who knows you, but to an incredible degree. Don't you feel an tidal wave of love coming your way?
I like them. But I think it's because I don't threaten anybody. I don't make any big decisions. I'm trying to say this nicely so I won't hurt my own feelings, but I mean, no Marilyn Monroe am I. I'm just not a threat to anybody. I like people, and I feel for them. Maybe more than I should, but good for me.
Maybe Joe DiMaggio disagrees with you.
What's that mean?
Marilyn Monroe? Maybe he has the same high regard.
Well, that's...
But your father must be very proud as he looks down today.
Oh, yes.
Mustn't he?
Yes.
He would.
Our mother said, what was it the other day?
Oh, it was so sweet. George's mother had her 88th birthday the other day, and she did not want a party and didn't want anything, but we gathered something like 34 members of the family, all ages around. We're sitting in this living room, and the children burst into happy birthday, and George leaned over to his mother, and he said, Mom, you've had a lot of birthdays. What's the best birthday you ever had? And she said, well, of course, today, George, I'm sitting holding the hand of my son, the President of the United States. Pretty nice.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Pretty nice.
And you see more of each other, the two of you, actually, you've said, in the White House than any time since China.
We do. I mean, we're home every night, working there.
You're liking what you say?
And tell me, do you, living in such a place of history and so on, do you sometimes feel the ghosts of presidents past looking down on you? I mean, does it...
Not really. You feel I see, like, reception pictures there. They have these prints. A prince from Abraham Lincoln was having a social reception, and I must say I stop and wonder, well, what was it like in those days? And then the people that, the curator and the ushers in the White House that know the histories talk about this used to be Franklin Roosevelt's office, or this was where the treaty was signed. This is the signed copy of the Gettysburg Address. All of these things right there. And so you do sense, you have more of a feeling that you're, you know, one of a handful of people to be president of the country and take pride in our country's history and all of that. But you're not overwhelmed by it.
But it is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
What's the awesome part? Just the realization of what's gone on there.
Yes,
in the last
here we are.
People who have lived there before you. You know, we've been very lucky, and I've had Betty Ford and Lady Bird Johnson come back, and other people who have lived in the White House just as friends. And to hear them walk through and talk, it does give you sort of a feeling of history and yeah. And responsibility for George.
Yeah, and to realize, yes, that you are now, for good and all, you are now an important part of history or future history yourself. That's quite...
It is. We aren't far... That hadn't made an impact yet. I don't think that happens till you've left. There's too much to do. There's too much churning, too much going on, too many, you know, things to try to do. And I don't think either of us think about our place in history or something like that.
That'll come to you at the end of your second term.
It'll be coming to me when I'm about 85 sitting up here and say, hey, come over here, kid. Let me tell you what it was like to be... Go on, get out of here. We got to finish our game. I'll be sitting hoping they'll want to listen to me. You know, but knowing these grandchildren, not a chance. They'll be on doing their thing, climbing these rocks.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.